interesting. There were two parts to the question. One is the issue that the question touches upon. The second is the examples which are intended to illustrate the issue. So maybe moving backwards. I don't know whether either of those examples really illustrate the issue. It's true that in our day, we're certainly aware of more gedolim who are ambivalent or maybe opposed to a certain degree to Medinas Yisrael. But if one broadens the historical scope, in Europe, the majority of Rabbanim belong, the majority of big Rabbanim belong to Mizrahi. There's a pendulum. Right now the pendulum is in one part of its arc. But I don't know that historically, the Osameach, who was one of the greatest, most towering figures, very enthusiastically embraced the Balfour Declaration. So I'm not sure, I just don't know factually, historically, whether that's accurate in terms of once one broadens the historical scope. I also don't know if you count heads on college. I'm not sure who's going to win the election here either. Basically, just in terms of those two, just in terms of the illustrations. In terms of the issue itself, again, if it's ever nogeya, if a person does have an issue which does illustrate that question. So the Gemara tells us that there is a machlokes between Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Akiva. So Mila, if the eighth day is Shabbos, if the baby is born Shabbos, and therefore the eighth day is Shabbos, so then Mila is Dolcha Shabbos. You do the Mila on Shabbos, even though the Mila involves Chilul Shabbos. So there's a machlokes between Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Akiva as to at what stage you can be Mechal al Shabbos for Mila. Rabbi Akiva says, which is how we paskin, that the only thing you can be Mechal al Shabbos for is what cannot be done before Shabbos. So the Mohel can't go start sharpening his knife if his surgical equipment is dull. He can't start sharpening that on Shabbos. If you need hot water to prevent infection, you can't boil that hot water on Shabbos, because all that could be done before Shabbos. That's what Rabbi Akiva holds, that's the way we pass it. And Rabbi Lezer was of the opinion, no, that Machshir and Mila are also Docha Shabbos. You can do that in Shabbos. You can start from scratch. You can start chopping down a tree to make a fire, to make a knife to use for the Mila. Even the Machshir and Mila are Docha Shabbos. The Gemara says that Bimkomo Shel Rabbi Lezer, they thought they used to do this. According to Rabbi Akiva, it was Chilul Shabbos. But the townspeople, Rabbi Lezer was their rav, so they used to follow Rabbi Lezer's psak. And what's more, Pam Achas, the Roman government, made a gzeira against Mila. They outlawed Mila, and the only exception was made was for Rabbi Lezer's hometown. I think, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure that I do, that the Gemara says the same thing, that Bim Komosh or Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Yossi Aglili thinks that there's no issa d'rabbanan of eating chicken with milk. We only have the d'oraisa of eating of eating besar behema with milk. There is no isa d'rabbanan of eating besar oaf, chicken meat with milk. Again, we don't pass like Rabbi Yossi Aglila. In d'rabbanan, we treat chicken meat like animal meat, and there's also a nisa vasi b'chalu. In Rabbi Yossi Aglili's town, they followed the view of Rabbi Yossi Aglili. It's entirely legitimate, as long as there hasn't been a Sanhedrin that put something to a vote and definitively resolves the issue, it's entirely legitimate if one is a Talmud, or a Talmud of a Talmud, or in the sphere of influence of a particular Adam Gadol, that one follows the views of that Adam Gadol, and it doesn't need to be the majority opinion. There are a lot of things that people do halacha l'maisa in Bnei Brak, which reflect the views of the Chazon Ish, where the Chazon Ish is very much a minority opinion. And they do that, and it's legitimate, and they should do that, because that's b'mkom shel Chazon Ish. When we were uprooted from Europe because of the Holocaust, so basically a lot of these types of local different minhagim were lost. But in Europe, you had a lot of it. In Europe, in Vilna, there were lots of things that were done differently than elsewhere, reflecting the Vilna Gaon, even when the Vilna Gaon was in the minority. So that's an entirely, again, legitimate and correct correct practice. If there are any questions, follow-ups, so please jump in.
Women rabbis, is it against halacha or just improper practice?
Both. By definition, historically, what smicha always represented was that the person with smicha was eligible to become the halachic authority in a town, in our mitzvahs, it's more often of a particular community centered around the shul than it is of a city or a town. Although in Eretz Yisrael, you still have that notion of a rav ha'ir, rav ha'moshav. In America, so we have it more in terms of particular communities which are centered around particular shuls. So what smicha always meant historically is that this person was qualified to wield halachic authority to which the people in that town, in that community, had to abide by. Let's say that the practice was always that when there was a rav ha'ir, the way it was in Europe, that a shochet couldn't just shecht in town. He would have to go present his knife, and he would have to get the approval of the rav ha'ir to engage in shechita. All of which is just to give a little bit of illustration of the fact that smicha basically is a title of srara. And the Rambam tells us in Hilchos Malachim, expanding upon a drasha of the Sifri, that some tosim alacha melech v'lo malka, v'hu adin l'chol mesimos, that the Torah says that positions of Sura are supposed to be occupied by men rather than women. In the Western mindset, so that's discrimination. Because in the Gaivadika Western world, so people covet power because it's an ego trip to be able to wield authority. So when this halacha is discussed within that Western mindset, so it translates in people's minds to discrimination. In a Torah mindset, having authority is something which is a tremendous burden and something that people always ran away from. A person is supposed to run away from authority and only agree to it when necessary. It's not something one covets. It's something that one answers for before the Ribbono Shel Olam, whether one exercised it correctly. So in a world where I think those of us in the room are the only ones who are not running for the Democratic nomination to be president in the year 2020, although I haven't ruled it out. Everyone covets. They give all the drushes, they're going to save the world, and that's why they're running. And that's the good talk. It's an ego trip. It's an ego trip. So within that mindset, so this halacha, within that mindset, so then the halacha taka is discriminatory, but that mindset is warped. A person is supposed to not want authority. A person, the same way, any leadership role, even something as relative to this, relatively insignificant as being shliach tzibur, a person is supposed to decline initially. And then there are dinim like that in Shulchan Aruch. It's reflected that a person is not supposed to run after it. A person is supposed to run away from it. Within that context, so it's a halacha. It's a distinction, not a discrimination. A distinction, not a discrimination.
Well,
what about the Pesekir, or those things that are the yourself? Thank you. Without intending to paint everyone with the same brush, without wrongly presuming to identify what everyone's motivations are. I'm not doing that at all. But there are certainly, undeniably, people for whom it's a stepping stone to women rabbis. And because of that context, I don't know that I'm entitled to an opinion, but for my zero sense worth, I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think it's a good thing. It's just a not-so-veiled attempt to make the first step, and not-so-veiled attempt at all.
This also relates to the previous question. There are Talmidei Chachamim within the mainstream Orthodox camp who do back the Yoatzot Halacha. So if a woman does have the right intentions and then she wants to join the program, would that be like following...
I don't know, the problem is even and I'm sure there are such women whose kavanas are pure and l'shem shamayim and have no inappropriate agenda. But if one recognizes this metzias, then basically those women are being co-opted into and by someone else's agenda. So I don't think it's so poshut, even if it's being done with the purest of motivations.
It, In which circumstances could we apply the Gemara of Kedei Lasos Nachas Ruach Anashim? That the Gemara said that they were allowed to do smicha with a shinoi when technically that would be aser, maybe derabanana, but they offered that.
Whatever the pshat in that Gemara is, the Gemara is not talking about Kedei Lasos Nachas Ruach if the impetus, when the impetus is an assimilationist one. The bottom line is, it's just so overwhelmingly clear that the Torah doesn't discriminate, but the Torah differentiates between men and women. And there's an awful lot in common in terms of mitzvos hamutalos aleinu, and in terms of chiyuvim, and in terms of aspirations that we're supposed to have. And then, undeniably, there are differences, and the Torah differentiates. Modern society doesn't like that. We're mushba from modern society. So because of that, we're trying to dray and twist halacha into something that doesn't... And here too, it's not even a thinly veiled campaign. It's a very... it's been a very open one for decades already. That's not what the Gemara was talking about. Kedei Lasos Nachas Ruach. 2,000 years ago, the world wasn't insane the way it is today. A woman wanted to do a mitzvah and didn't recognize that maybe there's a shayla v'avodah bekodshim in volunteering for that. So in that context, it has no application to our mitzvahs.
What does really feel
the
neo Hasidus?
I can't comment directly. I don't really know anything firsthand about what it is. So I can, but based on things that one hears second hand, third hand, fourth hand, maybe make a couple of general comments. Whether they're relevant, I can't even tell you. If they're relevant, are they relevant to the entire movement? Are they only relevant to certain parts of the movement? So then I leave that to those who are more up to date on the facts on the ground. Halacha certainly recognizes and appreciates the need and the legitimacy of looking to motivate people, looking to inspire people, and recognizes the need to do that for everyone on their level. All of that is implied and validated and encouraged by when the Gemara says, "The olam yasub adam b'torah mitzvos afilu shelo lishma shemitoch shelo lishma bo lishma." In terms of substance, I'm not aware of any mainstream interpretation of Yahadus that doesn't agree with the following statement. Again, so mainstream interpretation of Yahadus means whether one would identify as a Misnagdisha approach, a Lithuanian approach, or whether one that one would identify as a Hasidic approach. Avodas Hashem consists of Talmud Torah and Dikduk B'mitzvahs. Dveikus B'Hashem is achieved through a foundation of Talmud Torah and Dveikus B'Mitzvahs. And there are no shortcuts in that very lofty and noble pursuit. On my level, I can sit down and I can participate in something, and in a half hour, I can be inspired. But in a half hour, I'm not Dovik Basha, regardless of... It doesn't happen. There's no supersonic jet to Shamayim. A person can be inspired in a half hour, in an hour. A person doesn't go from where I'm holding to being Dovik Vashem. There's nothing that happens in a half hour other than Ma'amad HaSinai, but that was a one-time event that happened thousands of years ago. Within, for our purposes, with gross oversimplification, there are two types of Sifrei Chassidus. There are classics, holy works such as the Sfasemis, and the Siva Shalom. Which identify the and help us penetrate the religious spiritual experience. But for the most part, intentionally, and this was in general, was my father Zuchan Levracha once told me the tradition of Polish Hasidus, but basically exoteric. Basically what they're presenting is exoteric. They're not dealing with hardcore Kabbalistic concepts. Then there's another class of holy, sacred Sifrei Chassidus that deal with more hardcore Kabbalistic concepts. It never was the practice for someone. In the days of the Rishonim, there was even a Cherem. But it never was... never mind that. Erase that. It never was the practice for someone to engage in that study unless he was a very, very, very accomplished Talmud Chacham in Nigla, in Gemara, in Poskim, in Shas. And that's for a multitude of reasons. First of all, the level of Yiras Shamayim that's necessary before one is supposed to deal with those types of Svarim. The level of Yiras Shamayim to be Ro'uli, the level of Yiras Shamayim to have the Siyata D'Shmaya, those are two sides of a coin. Even the training of the mind, so that one develops a seichel hayosha, and additionally, and last but by no means least, agoda in general, and this is true of Kabbalah in particular, speaks in metaphors, speaks in metaphoric language. A person has to be anchored in nigla. A person has to be anchored in emunos, videos, and nigla in order to know what the nistar can mean and can't mean. And if a person doesn't have that knowledge base in nigla, do you hear this, Rabbi Bosse? If a person doesn't have that knowledge base in nigla, in exoteric knowledge, in what the Rambam tells us, in what Rav Sadyagon tells us about emuna, a person can't know where to draw the lines when studying esoteric wisdom. A person has to be anchored in nigla in order to study, in order to study nistar. How much, if anything, of that is relevant, I don't know.
What should the goal of learning Gemara be even be at this stage in our learning? And if I'm having a hard time appreciating the keys, what advice would Rebbe suggest to help appreciate it more?
So what was the first half of the question, Chris?
What should the goal of learning Gemara V'Iyun be at this stage in our learning?
The ideas and concepts of Torah are three-dimensional in the sense of possessing tremendous depth and profundity. Iyun is an attempt to penetrate to at least a little bit of that depth and glimpse at least a little bit of that profundity. How does a person learn Be'iyun? So I aim the first half of our conversation tonight. It doesn't happen overnight. But b'darach klal, I think that they say from Velvel Soloveitchik, he said the goal when you learn a Blat Gemara is that the page should be smooth. There shouldn't be any wrinkles. There shouldn't be any bumps. The page should be smooth. Which means that what clues us often to the fact that we're missing the depth of something is when there seems to be a non sequitur in the Gemara. Line 3 doesn't seem to follow logically from line 2. When Rashi seems to make a gratuitous comment, when the Rambam seems to say something against the Gemara, when Tosfos has a kasha that this Gemara is against, seems to be against another Gemara. So all those are bumps, all those are wrinkles. And those bumps and those wrinkles, it's when we encounter those bumps and we see those wrinkles, so that A, clues us and cues us to the fact that there's a depth here, there's a profundity that we're missing, and B, it also begins to guide us. The question is the first step in the pursuit of the answer. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of what a little bit of what Iyun means. When a person tries to delve without those hints and clues of the bumps and the wrinkles, so then a person can build an imaginary castle. A person can come up with can try to put a round peg into a square area, etc. The Rav Soloveitchik has a mini essay in which he juxtaposes a quote from the Nefesh HaChaim, from Rav Chaim Volozhiner, with a quote from the Baal HaTanya, from the Tanya. And it's remarkable, which was the point of his juxtaposition, how they say the same thing. Every din in the Torah represents Ritzon Hashem, represents Chochmas Hashem. Again, we're appreciating it to varying degrees, but even on the simplest level, it represents Ritzon Hashem. Maybe we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg, it represents Chochmas Hashem. A person by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so there's no, he's not distinct from his Ratzon and his Chochmah. When a person's Seichel is enveloped with a din, with an idea from the Torah, so then his Seichel, this is what both the Chaim Volozhiner and the Baal HaTanya explain, his Seichel, when his Seichel is melubosh with that, when his Seichel is enveloped by that idea, which is Ritzon Hashem, which is Chochmas Hashem, it's a way of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I think we're over time, right? We're in overtime? Okay, so. All right, so this is the 2-minute drill. Okay.
Your question is,
why couldn't Hashem just create something like the nature of the world to be that we don't have shame and just give us unlimited gifts and we don't have to work for it ourselves?
I mean, he could have, but he doesn't think that's the right thing. And it is something that as much as we don't like it, it is very intuitive to us if we're honest with ourselves.
A lot of times in the Torah and working on a person, I feel like comes with this negative side effect that you examine people around you a little closer. So what are the things a person can do to kind of limit his eyesight to just him?
That's a very, very important question. maybe there are a couple of reminders that we can give ourselves. One is, you know, Chazal said, right? That one can't judge one's friend, a fellow Jew, until one is standing in his place, until one is standing in his shoes. But the truth is, and that's what Chazal really had in mind, that never happens. Even if two people grow up in the same community, go to the same school, maybe they're even siblings and they grow up in the same family, everyone's personality is unique and therefore different. And the interaction between the same, maybe it's the same family experience, maybe it was the same school, maybe it's the same community, but Reuven is different than Shimon, Shimon is different than Reuven, and the challenge that poses to Reuven is not the challenge it poses to Shimon. So does a person ever know, can a person ever really think that I'm better than someone else? I don't know, so maybe I got a 90 on the test and he got an 85 on the test, but maybe my 90 came so much more easily to me than his 85, that maybe his 85 reflects that he's a better person than my 90 reflects. Maybe my, maybe one person's diktuk b'mitzvahs, I don't know. Only Rebbeinu Shalom knows how that compares to someone who's not as medakdek, but who knows what his challenges were. And even if one knows the external circumstances, Hashem Yireh LeLevav, no one knows the internal circumstances. That's one reminder. A second reminder that we can and should give ourselves . Let's say two people get drunk and they go on a drunken rampage and vandalizing and stealing. And then the next morning, so they decide to go assess how much damage each room did. So one guy caused $500,000 worth of damage, in addition to which stole $25,000 worth of goods. The other guy only caused $480,000 worth of damage and only stole $20,000. So the second guy's in a position to judge the first guy. I'm a much better person than you are. The first perspective we gave asks a question and gives an answer. The second one, like, who am I to judge? Not what's the answer. Not what's the answer. Explain to me why I'm not better than the other person. The second one says, who am I to judge? If I just did $480,000 worth of damage in a drunken rampage, it's not for me to judge anyone. When a person sees how much more he needs to do, It's not that there's an answer to the question, but the question doesn't get asked.
There's like a concept. There's like a concept in like Gemara, like a lot of Musar Sfarim, that to be like compassionate, firm, that like when someone embarrasses you in public or wrongs you, you kind of just take it, and like that's like being the bigger person. But like alternatively, like the Sefer HaChinuch, like it says, like to not be like a doormat, like to not just be like pushed over. It's like, what's like the middle ground?
Again, it's not really possible to. To to answer the question fully without dealing with a very, very specific concrete example, because the answer is going to be tweaked depending upon what the example is. The answer is going to be adjusted depending upon what the actual case would be. The Sefer Chinuch doesn't disagree that if my only need to respond is my bruised ego, the Sefer Chinuch doesn't disagree that the highest level and that the ultimate goal is the Sefer Chinuch says that that's not always required. And that within certain limits that a person is allowed to respond. But I don't think he's disagreeing with what others say in terms of what the goal is. The Rambam writes in Shmoneh Parakim, I think. Yeah, maybe on the Mishnah of, actually I don't remember words, but either in Shmoneh Parakim or in the Perush on Arvos. He writes that a certain chassid was once asked what the happiest moment in his life was. So he said that he was once he was very, very poor, destitute. So he was once on a ship and he couldn't afford to pay full price for passage. So they put him down in the in the boiler room of the ship, and they stuck him there. And then there were these rich, it doesn't have to be this way, but in the case of the Moshe, it was this way, arrogant noblemen who, you know, were dressed in all their finery, who were staying in the first-class cabins. And they had complete disdain, complete bittle for the poor people and felt very superior. So this, the Rambam describes how this chassid said the happiest moment in his life was when one of these arrogant people, and the Rambam gives this example, I apologize for, when one of these arrogant people went and urinated on him to show complete contempt and disdain, and he said he didn't feel anything. Wasn't angry, didn't feel anything. There was no guy in him. He didn't feel anything. They tell a story that Chaim Volozhin, whom we mentioned before, about the Nefesh HaChayim. So he had a younger brother who was a legendary figure, Reb Zalman from Volozhin. So the two of them were once traveling together, and it was late at night, and they had to stop. It was dangerous to travel anymore in the dark, and the roads weren't safe. And they came to an inn, and the innkeeper dealt with them very gruffly and crudely, and said, "No, I don't need you. Get out of here," and just threw them into his barn. Roughed them up and threw them into his barn and said, "You want to stay? You can stay with my horses overnight." And Rav Chaim Volozhin looks and sees that Rav Zalman is crying. He says to him, "What are you crying? It's an olam hasheker. Who cares what he says?" He says, "No, that's not why I'm crying. I'm crying because I felt something when he said that. So that's why I'm crying." The Sefer Chinuch doesn't disagree that this is the ideal. He says it's not required. He says the Torah recognizes human weakness, and this is optimal. This is mitzvah men amufka. It's not required. But he doesn't disagree that that's the ideal, that that's the goal. Thank you very much for listening.